When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.
Hi, I'm Hannah Brown, and welcome to Better Tomorrow. My absolute favorite thing to do is have a heart-to-heart talk with my new friends and my best friends, where we sit down and talk about all the things like relationships and love, faith, and self-care. And of course, the little things as well, like the struggle to figure out what to eat tonight. All in all, I really want to ask, how am I better today than yesterday? And bring artists, entrepreneurs, and friends along on the journey. So join me on the journey, will you? Hi, Vienna.
Hello. So excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you on the Better Tomorrow podcast, guys. We have Vienna Farron on the podcast today. And you guys know that I'm so thankful for all the therapy that I've done in my life. And it's a big part of my life right now. And Vienna is a licensed marriage and family therapist, but also the best-selling author of her amazing book. I loved it, by the way. The Words of You.
Thanks.
And you have your own podcast called This Keeps Happening. So I just kind of want to get into what made you pursue being a therapist in the first place. And what is the most challenging thing about being a therapist?
I always say that whether we know it or not, we get into the work of therapy to resolve that which is unresolved in our own lives. And yeah, if you had asked me this long ago, I would not have realized that that was why I was getting into the field of marriage and family therapy. I think back in the day, I would have said, I'm so good at talking to my friends and everybody comes to me for relationship advice and it's like, I enjoy that. And, you know, little did I know how much I still needed to resolve in my own life. Unsurprisingly, my parents went through a 9-year divorce process that started when I was in first grade. It was really tumultuous, high conflict, lots of manipulation, gaslighting, psychological abuse, paranoia, emotional flooding, just high conflict. And I was someone who would present to the world and say, my parents' divorce didn't affect me at all. Like, I was totally cool, calm, collected, unaffected, unbothered, totally fine. I remember even when I was in grad school to become a marriage and family therapist, like the advisors and supervisors and professors, you know, they're like, tell us about the impact, right? We're learning about this stuff. And I'm like, we're good. Bless them, right? Because they must have been like, oh, this sweet girl who has a lot to learn and a lot to connect to. But yeah, I got into it because I thought that I would be good at it. I didn't realize that I came to actually resolve the unresolved stuff in my life, which is something that I've obviously been able to do over the time I've been a therapist now for almost, I guess, over 17 years now. The hardest part of being a therapist, that's really evolved, I think, over time. I think that you have it's common to take on a lot of your clients' stuff. And, you know, we feel, of course, we're deeply empathetic people. But sometimes it's like the over-functioning, the over-feeling, the taking on people's stories outside of the session and wanting to save them or fix something, right? And again, that's a really novice and sort of unevolved way of looking at the field of being a therapist. But I think early on, you know, it's like, oh, you can kind of see where a person maybe needs to go and you want to get them there, but allowing people to walk their path and be there with them alongside, even when they misstep or even when it takes them, you know, much longer than, you know, you maybe would hope it would. But I would say that right now at this point in my career, being a therapist is be like, do you burn out? I'm like, I don't, you know, it feels so reciprocal. It's so expansive to be in conversation with all of my clients. I care deeply about them. I have such love for them. And it's such a give and take. And when you see people growing and you see people healing, like, it's just such a beautiful gift for us on the other side of it.
Totally. I wonder if there's like times when you're working with a couple or an individual, like, do you find yourself not just like getting involved, but being like, oh my gosh, like seeing yourself so much in them? Do you feel like there's times where you're like, oh, like when you're seeing the things that they're working through, you're like, I need to work on that as well. Does that happen quite a bit?
It does. It does. And it's interesting because a lot of times, you know, you'll be with your clients for, you know, a period of time and you might be similar in age or you might be in a similar like chapter of life. And so it's interesting to watch certain things unfold. A lot of therapists will say this where they're like, oh my gosh, like all of my clients are now presenting with the same thing that I'm going through, or they're reflecting something back to you. And you're like, yeah, that's a thing in my life right now that, you know, I'm having to face. And it's interesting for me right now. My father, this is, you know, something that I've talked about openly before. I have an older father. My father is 86 years old. And, you know, it's sort of this process of coming into this final chapter of life. And, you know, what's that relationship look like? And is there something that needs to be reconciled or addressed in this final chapter? And of course, I have all of these clients too, who have parents who are in this final chapter of life, right? And so it's really interesting to have those conversations and, you know, to find parts of yourself in there.
Totally. You kind of, said previously, like there's sometimes you'll watch a client going through something and I feel like there's like this line of how much you like you want to help them, but they also have to do it, the work themselves.
Yeah.
Where is that line for you? Are there times where you will I don't know, like intervene in some way? Because I know I've had therapist in the past that really just like kind of let me just continually spiral. I feel like I fully like I wanted to be better, but I didn't know how on my own, especially at first. And now I have a therapist that is definitely more involved. She doesn't take on as many clients. Mm-hmm. But where do you feel like that line is of how much a therapist should be like giving advice, being involved in someone's life? And what have you seen, you know, work the best for your clients?
Yeah. You know, I think really great therapy is when, you know, the art form intersects with the science, you know, like what we know. Mm-hmm. And that's why you can't just follow a very rigid protocol of never do this or only do that or always do this, right? You have to sense, you know, who you're in the room with, what the situation is, what a person might be able to receive in a particular moment. Now, I think generally we stay away from just like preaching advice, right? Like that's not usually what you're going to find in mm-hmm. a therapy space. But, you know, there have certainly been times, and I think especially if a client is in, you know, a dangerous situation, or there's something that you really see clearly where you really need to name it with them, right? Like, absolutely, that's appropriate. And also, I think it depends on what your relationship with the therapist is and with the client. You know, it's like if you've just met and you've had, you know, 7 sessions versus, you know, you've been in therapy with someone for 5 years, right? Like there's going to be a sense of safety and a sense of trust in that space that is really established. And so there might be moments where you might say, can I reflect something back to you? Or can I point something out to you that I would like for us to maybe have a different conversation about. And again, it's still for the client to always choose. We're never trying to choose for someone. We shouldn't be choosing for someone, but we want to challenge them. And if they're not seeing something, or if there's a pattern that we're like, we've been on this pattern for, you know, many years together. So might I just highlight that this beautiful pattern is presenting itself again. And so can we look at this a little differently, right? It's like the challenging of that, I think, is really vital in the therapeutic relationship. And so again, I'm not choosing for you, but I'm going to point to things. I'm going to point things out. I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to have you look at something and make contact with something that I believe that you can make contact with, even if you're not making contact with it on your own.
Yeah. My therapist has like this phrase that she says, she's like, I give you the chance, but you get the choice. So like, I think that's what a therapist, sometimes when you have somebody to talk to, can kind of give you that backboard to kind of like have the opportunity to actually see like what's in front of you that sometimes is just like in your blind spot, but ultimately another person can't make you change. There's a lot of work that has to go on outside of that, you know, however long session. And I don't know, I watched this podcast, or I actually didn't watch it, but it came up like on my Instagram. I didn't listen to it. You know, when people are like, oh yeah, I heard this thing, or I read this article. It's like, no, I saw TikTok about it. About just like some people sometimes question therapy of just like, okay, what are we doing in therapy? What's the goal of this? Is the goal for like, do you think people should be in therapy long-term? Is the goal to, you know, stay in therapy forever? Like, what do you see therapy as, and should there be like a time frame of how long you're doing this process?
Yeah, I think at its in its most basic sense, you're coming in with a particular goal, with a presenting issue, and if you have met that goal, then you're checking in to see if there's another goal that you have, or whether it's maybe time for a break. I believe that our healing is a lifetime thing, but that it's often done in chapters, meaning we probably don't need to be, some people like it. Some people like to have a space every week that they come to and, you know, they process some stuff and, you know, it's part of their practice. Lovely, right? Like to each their own in the way that they want to utilize this. But I do think that we will meet new parts of ourselves at different chapters in our lives, right? There's something that's presenting right now. Maybe I keep dating the same people or keep pursuing the same type of person over and over again. And I really want to understand this pattern. Like I, you know, this sort of the idea of like, I know better, but I can't choose differently in the moment. Or then, you know, you become a parent and you become confronted with this shift in role, and it's bringing you closer in contact with your relationship with your mother. And now you're needing to process through that. Or, you know, decades later, you're starting to lose your friends and your relationship with mortality is beginning to present, right? It's like there will always be something, right, that is going to confront you along the path. And so, yeah, I think on its most basic front, it's you are coming in with a specific goal likely in mind. And that when you reach that goal, that's when the reassessment of, okay, like I'm going to go back out into the world on my own and, you know, use the tools that I have here. Or is there another chapter that has presented during my time in this therapy with you? Because I think a lot of times people will come in with something specific and then you're like, let's talk about your childhood.
Yes, I have to go into that. Yeah.
Right. You're like, there's so much more to address. Right.
Yeah. It presents as one thing. It's like, I just don't understand why this happens in my relationship. And then it's like, that's the surface. Mm-hmm. And then underneath, it's like all this stuff. That has been my experience, I'll say. Today is about looking for new ways to better ourselves, but sometimes that means looking in a totally different place or even a different state. In South Dakota, travel is transformative. It's good for the soul. It's the kind of place to just let go, to escape from routine and predictability of life, to put down the phone and pick up a sense of adventure, and to see the world a little bit differently, as in not through our screen? Life in South Dakota is about unplugging from it all and connecting with the world around you. It's about being open to real surprises and treating your senses to a real, raw, natural beauty that doesn't need a filter. Whether you're exploring the mountains and trees of the Black Hills, hiking through the Badlands, navigating the wild towns, or camping under the stars, South Dakota is the place to get a little lost and find yourself along the way. See why there's so much South Dakota, so little time at TravelSouthDakota.com. And that kind of gets me to, in your practice and in your book, The Origins of You, you dive pretty deeply into the impact of our family of origin. Can you just share with those that are listening, never heard that, like what that is and how does that impact all the ways in which we live our life?
You're like, every which way. Yeah. This is relevant for you if you are a human being and you have a family.
Yes.
So, my work, obviously we know that there's lots of influences and there's lots of things that shape us, from teachers to coaches to religion to society to media to past relationships, partnerships, friends, families, for example, right? Like the list goes on. And my work specifically, though, is looking at the family system in which we grew up. That could be one, if you had an intact family. If you're like me, that was two family systems. My parents divorced. And so I'm learning how to operate in both of these systems apart from one another. And for other folks, right, they might have had more than two. There might have been lots of people sort of coming in, leaving, et cetera. And so, yeah, I look at the family system, the family of origin, and really like the template, the blueprint, the foundation for how we relate to just about everything, right? It's the first place that we learn about communication and conflict and intimacy and boundaries and love and partnership, on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, there's, for many of us, you know, there's things that might stand out that are really impactful. We hear this word of trauma, you know, all the time now. But I also really like to sort of stretch that out a little bit, because a lot of times people will come into therapy and they're like, well, I don't have any trauma, you know, or like, mm-hmm. I know some people who have this story that's just so much worse than mine is. And so like, I feel like I had it pretty good. And it's really important for me to actually invite every human into this conversation. And that's why I use the word wounds in the book, because I want people to not overly identify with that word trauma, where they're like, okay, that's not me. So I don't get to have a relationship with my pain, or I don't get to have a relationship with the things that impacted me or influenced me. And so that feels really important for me to say sort of out of the gates here with that. We know that we grow up in imperfect systems, even when we have parents who were great or who did the best that they could, right? It's like, we still are going to have experiences along the way that impact us and have us questioning our relationship with our worth, our value, our sense of belonging, how important we are to the important people in our lives, our relationship with trust, and our relationship with feeling safe and secure in the world. And that's the invitation of this book, right? It's not to go on some, you know, goose hunt and, you know, try to like throw our parents under the bus. It's about turning back around and looking at our story and understanding that somewhere along the way, something likely shifted our trajectory when it comes to these wounds, worthiness, belonging, prioritization, trust, and safety. And when we get caught comparing our story to someone else's, or when we have the explanation for why our caregiver couldn't do XYZ, or we say, well, they did the best that they could, or they were so much better than their parents were for them, or I'm afraid of opening Pandora's box, right? It's like, these are all of the reasons why we don't like to turn back around. And yet, it's something that is so important. I've worked with over 25,000 hours of working with individuals, couples, and families, and there has not been a single time where this has not been an important piece of the therapeutic process. Not to stay stuck in the past, not to hang out in there forever, but to acknowledge and honor our story. Our story deserves to be acknowledged and honored. And so, yeah, the looking through and looking at our family of origin and seeing some of the residual stuff that's there is really important. I've been saying patterns, our unwanted patterns in our adult lives, and like hands up, because we know we all have them. Like we've had one or two before in the past, right? It's like the unwanted patterns in our adult lives that we can't shake are pain's way of grabbing for our attention. It's the irresolution from the past that is tugging at our coats, that's saying, hey, can you just turn around and look at me for a little bit of time so that we can resolve this and tend to it? So that, and like, I promise I'll let go of you after that. You know, it's like, I don't need you to keep coming back here. But if you just try to survive your way through and white knuckle your way through, then we're never actually addressing, witnessing, honoring the pain that was.
Totally. And it's always going to, I know for me, I tried to white knuckle, and I knew there was like real trauma in my life that nobody could like, it was like definitely had experienced trauma, but I still felt like, oh, like I can't let that doesn't define me. It's not like who I am. And like, also people have it way worse than me. Yeah. But then eventually it catches up with you. And it's so much, I mean, it did for me at least. Like I couldn't white knuckle anymore. I got too tired and I had to let go. And then it's like, oh, I just fell in a bunch of mud. And now I just, I have no other option. But for my fiance, we started doing couples therapy together. But before we started doing that, I remember one day we were in the car and we were listening to some type of podcast, healing podcast. And I looked at him and I was like, so is there like, well, is there anything that you would change from your childhood? Because he seemingly came from like a wonderful, perfect family, perfect in air quotes. Mm-hmm. And even then he was like, no, there's not one thing I would change. And I was like, oh gosh, we've got something here. Because I'm like, every person, no matter how beautiful, loving their family was, there is something that hurt you, whether they like intentionally or not, or there is some dynamics that in some way wounded you. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to uncover that. And now that we've started the therapy, you know, now it's been such an eye-opening thing from him of like, not always, even though he was in a safe family, sometimes he didn't feel really seen and safe. Mm-hmm. And it can be little things that actually make a big impact. I mean, for me, this is outside of my family of origin, but it can sound so silly. And I want to say this because I feel like there's people that listen sometimes that just don't feel like whatever they went through is important or it's not that big of a deal. And that's why they keep brushing it. Like, I painted an Easter egg in first grade that literally that moment, and had friends make fun of my Easter egg, made me stop being creative. Like I can pinpoint when I realized, oh, I'm not good at this. Yep. And I shouldn't like invest in this. And I know it sounds so silly, but it hurt me so much. And so think about the people that we spend all of our time with. Everybody has a moment of something like that intentional or not, left a big impact and made us think of ourselves differently. And I love that you brought that up.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that example because I think we do get caught looking for the big stuff, you know, the stuff that feels so obvious. And the obvious stuff is so easy to find and to pinpoint. I had a client who, you know, actually years into the therapy, he was just sharing a story with me. It was like, oh, you know, when I was in fifth grade, I had a crush on this girl. And, you know, she knew that I had the crush on her, maybe said something about it. And her response to the friend group was, oh, I would think that he was cute if only he were taller. And kind of similar to your Easter egg experience, right? It's like, sort of, here's this like little moment in a fifth grader's life, you know, that you're like, oh, it's kind of subtle, like, oh, bummer, you know, on we go. And no, right? Because it's like, it's this thing that shifts your trajectory with your worth, my worth or my value as a human being, right? It's tied to my height in this example. And to think about the way that presents, you know, decades later is, you know, he was somebody who would, have to become really good friends, like best friends with women first before dating them, because it was sort of this extra layer of protection, right? If we are really good friends, if you see what a great human I am, then you're going to be more likely or more willing to look over the fact that I am shorter, right? Yeah. And so again, I really love that you gave that example, because when we get lost looking for just the big stuff, we forget these little moments along the way that are actually significant moments, that are actually big moments in many of our lives that do change this trajectory and relationship with how we see ourselves and how we see the world around us. And yeah, that invitation for people to really say, like, when was the first time, or when was a time in which my worth, you know, was questioned, my belonging was questioned, me as a priority was questioned. Like, it doesn't always come from sort of these malintended places. In the prioritization chapter, I share about a client of mine. His alias in the book is Andre, single mama working multiple jobs. She's sacrificing so much for him. He knows this, right? He can rationalize this. He loves her. He respects her. They go to church on Sundays. They go to brunch afterwards. And then she goes to her shift in the afternoon. So the only time that they get, right, is Sunday mornings. And he sits there and he's like, but she's doing everything to prioritize me, to prioritize my success, my future, all the things, right? But it didn't change the fact that he felt deprioritized through time spent. All he wanted was to spend more time with her. Yeah. So again, I just share these examples because I hope that people can find themselves in some of these stories and not just only look for the big stuff that they equate with being worth spending time with, you know,
totally.
Like actually addressing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I love that in your book. Cause you have multiple in the book, there's like multiple clients that you work with that you give the examples of things that they're going through, and some are big, but some they're all big because they impacted you, you know,
right.
But there's ones that you're like, okay, like I can definitely, we can all call that, I guess, like out the big T trauma, but man, right. When there's a compound of those little mm-hmm. wounds, it hurts just as much, sometimes worse, because you haven't given it any attention,
right?
Because you didn't feel like it needed it. What are some of the common origin wounds that people have, and how can we kind of find and pinpoint those wounds within ourselves and what that, you know, original wound may be?
Yeah. When I sat down to write the book, I'm like scribbling down all the possible wounds that any human could, you know, ever have. And I felt like these five really honored the human experience. So maybe you've heard me sort of rattle them off in this conversation mm-hmm. already, but the worthiness wound, the belonging wound, the prioritization wound, the trust wound, and the safety wound. Worthiness, when I was writing about that, I was like, I feel like every human probably rubs up against worthiness at some point or another. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be true. Like, this is probably the one that feels most relatable, most common. I put out this quiz about what's your primary origin wound, and the like stats came back. Yeah, that showed worthiness was. Yeah. And listen, we can have multiple. I have a worthiness wound as well. But hands up for the perfectionists, the pleasers, the peacekeepers, the comic relief, right? Like if that sounds like you, likely you rub up against a worthiness wound. The way that it gets established is often through conditional love, meaning what are the conditions mm-hmm. for me as a kiddo to get attachment, closeness, connection, love, presence, peace, safety, calm in the home. Okay, when you bring home straight A's, mom is really happy. When you score the hat trick on the field, dad is present. When you are funny, dad stops hurting your sister. When you do X, then Y is what happens, right? It's sort of this understanding of this is how I need to present, right? This is how I have to perform in this space in order to get the thing that I want. Part of my worthiness wound really deepened in that I briefly share this in how I became a therapist, right? It's like, here's what my family was going through. And I became the girl who sort of flew under the radar. I was totally fine, unaffected, unbothered, no boundaries, et cetera. And so when I was presenting as like the good little girl, all was good, all was okay. As a teenager, when I would present like just challenge a boundary or push back on something, my dad would respond, like the punishment was by giving me the silent treatment, sometimes for days, sometimes for weeks on end. And it really added an extra layer on top of where my worthiness was hanging out already, because it was saying that when you are easygoing, when you don't have needs or push a boundary or speak up for yourself or anything like that, then you get connection and close. My dad was amazing, right? He was super supportive, super helpful, super fun, you know, available, would prioritize me in any which way. But the moment that I was challenging, right, was the moment that all of that would be taken away. And, you know, you can imagine as a kiddo, like days without talking to a parent, weeks without being acknowledged, like that's hard, right? And so no wonder, you know, I like turned into an adult, right? Who is the cool girl persona, who is totally fine, boundaryless, do whatever you want. It's okay. I'm really unbothered. And it was so, like the incongruency was so huge. So again, a lot of times we will see the performers, the perfectionists, the peacekeepers, sort of the managers in that space with the worthiness wound. Of course, some folks, you know, will just hear statements of harm, right? Where they hear like, you are unworthy, you are a piece of crap, you are this, right? That make you question that. But the way we all internalize it, right? It's like, that's person to person. You know, you could have somebody with a parent who abandons when they're a kiddo, and one person will internalize it as a worthiness wound. You left because I wasn't worth you sticking around. Somebody else could internalize that as a trust wound. You left and now I cannot trust the important people in my life to stick around, right? And so you don't just fit into a box. This is your own particular self-inquiry with the things that happen to say, like, how did you internalize it? What story did you create and make out of this experience? And in what way is that affecting you today? So yeah, the worthiness wound is definitely a really big one. And I think a lot of people will resonate, relate to it. The belonging wound, kind of like what it sounds like, you know, some families, I don't know if this was your family, but you know, where they're like, this is who we are. This is what we believe. This is how we operate in the world, right? There's sort of this like team mentality, you know, like, and if you step outside of what we think, do, believe, behave, right, then you're not like us. You're not one of us. And, you know, Dr. Gabor Mate talks about attachment and authenticity as being these like two lifelines for us as children. And when attachment is threatened, we will always trade authenticity. Yeah. You need me to be more of this, less of that. You need me to abandon this part of myself in order to be connected to you. I will. I have to, because it is quite literally our survival when we are kiddos, right? And so when you... a lot of times it'll present when we have really controlling parents, when we have intolerable caretakers, right? Where our differences, there's no room for the differences here. It's like, nope, I cannot even face this difference because your difference is too confronting for me generally as the adult. Yeah. And so there's a lot of like having to shape shift in order to create this false sense of belonging. It's really fitting in, you know, a true sense of belonging would allow you to keep your authenticity, right? To be actually who you are, in its ever-changing state, but to be who you are at any moment. And so, yeah, the folks, you know, folks who just feel like they didn't fit in, they were the black sheep in the family. They felt othered, we'll see this in culture too, as well, so much, right? Where it's like, you know, you have a black student in a predominantly white school, or you have someone who, you know, is going to a private school, but they're there on a scholarship and they don't have, you know, their family doesn't have any money, right? And so there's like a lot of having to kind of blend in and adapt in a certain way in order to feel or attempt to have that sense of quote unquote fitting in, right? So yeah, feeling othered, feeling like you're not part of the group, you know, you're not in. And so you see people are like, oh, you know, the fear of missing out, a constant like adaptation as an adult, not lining up your insides with your outsides, saying what you think the other person wants to hear, right? It's like all of those things, like how do I actually belong in this group or with this person? Prioritization is when you didn't feel like an important person to the important people in your life. A lot of times with the adults in our lives, that might be they're a workaholic or they're struggling with an addiction, or there's a high conflict in the family, or you have a sibling who has, you know, mental health challenges and all of the attention is going to that child instead of you. Or after a divorce, mom just is dating constantly and, you know, is really focused on that and is really disconnected from you, or you're not feeling prioritized in the relationship. You don't feel important to the important people in your life. The trust wound, you know, there's a rupture in trust that often happens through deceit, betrayal, lies. Some of the big stuff, some of the things that we would think about right off the bat would be an infidelity, for example. But family secrets, one that you're having to keep, one that's been kept from you. Sometimes we have a parent who gambles away a college fund, or someone who took out a credit card in your name when you were a kiddo and you find out later that your credit is shot because a parent did that. But also times the subtle stuff that we're talking about before, where it's like, you know, a parent consistently making a promise that they don't keep, you know, like over and over again, and just believing like, oh, okay, I cannot trust the people who I thought that I could trust. Or we just get sweeping generalizations. All men are this, never trust a man, right? Like I think a lot of folks maybe heard some of those stories growing up. And then the last one, the safety one, when we're talking about the absence of safety, we are often talking about the presence of abuse. So it's a really tender wound. But all the different pillars, the emotional, the physical, the sexual, the mental, the spiritual, the, you know, on and on we go. But recklessness, negligence, just this feeling that our overall well-being was not respected, honored, seen, protected, cared for. That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Big breath.
So you're saying that we can have more than one going on at one time from different wounds?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, I feel like I can check a lot of those boxes.
You know how many DMs I get that are like, is it possible to have all five? Yeah, it's possible. They're like, just checking for a friend, you know? You're like, yep.
I'm not a parent yet, but I feel like people who are probably parents right now are, it can be scary to hear all this of like, oh my gosh, have I already messed my kid up? How do you take in that information? What would you say to a parent to like encourage them when receiving this? And like, what can they do to, And is there something they can do to protect their child from not feeling any of these things from however they're parenting?
It's a great question. I am a parent, so I definitely can relate to that part that's like, oh, you know, we don't want to pass the hurt or the harm. We want to protect them. And also, right, like how many times have we heard that like you're going to fail at that? You know, you're not going to be successful at creating a perfect environment, a perfect scenario. And in fact, we don't really want to do that because they do need to resolve things in their lives. We'd like to protect them from the big stuff, of course. And also we don't exist in vacuums. They are going to live out their lives. We are going to get some things wrong. There's going to be moments where we say the wrong thing or we prioritize something else instead of them. And I think what I have found is that as a parent, your relationship to being able to take ownership, accountability, responsibility, and to apologize where it is appropriate is one of the greatest gifts that you will ever give your child. I don't work with children in my practice, but I work with adults who have all been children before. And what I learn, right, is that no matter how late it is in the game, decades, whatever it is, to be acknowledged from a wholehearted place, right? To like really feel that authentic expression of, you know what, this one's on me, right? I realized that I did X, Y, Z, and I want to take ownership. I want to take responsibility for that. That witnessing of that is so powerful and it's so healing. I would encourage us to try not to wait decades to do that. I think the race as adults to repair with our children is one of the greatest skill sets that we can practice to get to a place where we can say, I see myself and I am willing to own what it is that I just did and bring that forward to you is so, so healing. What is hard about feedback, and especially as parents, it's so tender, but that feedback loop is that it wants to put us into a shame spiral, a guilt spiral, an embarrassment spiral. Oh, I'm a terrible mother. Oh, I can't believe I did that. And so we go into this self-protective place first. No one likes to feel shame. It's not a great one. No one loves to feel embarrassed. Right? We don't want to stay away from that. And so we go to this place and then we want to protect ourselves. Well, had you not spilled the milk, had you not listened to me, then this wouldn't have happened, right? And so we make it about them. Emotional maturity asks us, and this is any relationship, but obviously we're talking about it in the parent-child relationship. Emotional maturity asks us to be able to hold ourselves up as a human being, to receive that feedback, oftentimes our own self-feedback, not even them telling us that you're a crap mother or whatever, right? It's like to receive that feedback and to not go to a place of needing to self-protect, but rather relationally protect. You, my child, are experiencing something. And it is my job in this emotionally mature state to honor what it is that you are experiencing. And so, yeah, I know it's a long answer to your question, but it's such an important one. No, but it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's like that's at the core of it, because you will make mistakes and you will let them down and you will disappoint them. It's not about never doing that. It's about the moments when that does happen, being able to step into that ownership and accountability as quickly as possible. Yeah, it's a hard thing, but it is a muscle worth, you know, developing and practicing.
I have a question for some of us who, you know, there's that line of we go into this work and then we're like, I don't want to put the blame on my parents because of what they did to mess me up. And I feel like you've talked about that, like how to look at that differently. But what about that part of you that is almost resentful or upset that our parents didn't do the work on themselves? Like, how do we avoid, you know, being resentful of the ways our parents didn't meet our needs? And how can we, like, do we talk to our parents about this? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that?
I think this is a balancing act, the intersection of compassion and grace for others, and also ownership, responsibility, and accountability. All of my work is about holding context, and also that context doesn't excuse behavior. Right. It's like at the end of the book, there's this offering from another psychotherapist, Michael Kerr, and he says to think of your mother as your grandmother's daughter and to see how that shifts your perspective. And I love that. Again, not to excuse behavior, but to be like, right, we were all tiny little humans in a likely complicated, challenging system. And we're all sort of walking around maybe with unresolved wounds, unresolved pain, unresolved trauma. And we know, right, like the generations before us, right, like our access to therapy and, you know, these conversations, the fact that you and I are having this conversation on your podcast right now, right? It's like, this is material that's like out in the world all of the time. And so many of us benefit from listening to this stuff, not what our parents, not what our grandparents had access to, definitely not the same thing. And so I think, hey, you know, how we navigate that space is that we have to have grace and compassion for human beings. We are all in this human experience together. And that it is also okay for us to feel what we feel and experience what we experience, right? Like, you might have to make contact with your resentment, or you might need to make contact with your anger around what went down. But I think that when we can hold the humanness with the responsibility and accountability, that's probably our best path forward. And I think, you know, whether we're thinking about parents or we're thinking about a partner in a particular moment, and you're like, oh, right, like you're a tiny human who grew up in a complicated system as well. And that probably makes sense why you're doing this thing that I can't stand or the thing that I feel really hurt by. Again, not to excuse your behavior, but to hold a much more systemic frame about what's happening here.
Totally. So do you think that's also just depending on the situation of kind of how you said, like it's never too late to have a parent apologize or make amends or acknowledge a pain that you have. Mm-hmm. Would you say for us to, you know, bring that to our parents, or does it, what if your parents, like, you're like, I know they're not going to hear this, mm-hmm. and it might just be more hurtful. Would you just say, okay, you're not going to get what you want here, so that's not the best option? Like, how do you make that distinction?
Yeah. Well, I think you make that distinction because we probably have a pretty good set of data points around mm-hmm. whether or not that person in our lives is really available to it or not. I think a lot of times we get caught trying and trying and trying. Maybe if I write it to you in a letter, maybe if I say it to you calmly, maybe if I scream it at you, maybe that, right? It's like, check. I've been through all of that whole list. Like all the above, right? And you're like, oh, right. There's, I think a lot of times, I've said this before, like acceptance is where the grief is. And it can be so deeply painful for us to say, in this chapter, I acknowledge and accept that this is not changing. We are desperate to have the people we care about and want to have affirm and validate and acknowledge something change. We're desperate for that. There could be nothing that feels better in our lives to have a parent say, I am so sorry. I see what I did, right? Like that it's part of the fantasy, right? That like, oh, then it melts away. But what happens is that we often go back into a space that's where that is not available. And it, to your point, like it can actually be reharming, right? And just rewounding. And so, yes, this takes our discernment. I do believe in people's capacity for change. I have the deep honor of working with people day in and day out who I see change all the time. I also know that people don't change. And that's what makes life hard. You know, it's like, right? It's like, you know, and so I really like the idea of looking at chapters. Might a parent in a different chapter of their life be able to create change? Maybe. But in this chapter, what do we know? Right? In this chapter right now, what do we know? I tell people like, let's stop being surprised by unsurprising things, said lovingly, right? Like mm-hmm. what do we know? What is the information that we have? And I think sometimes when we resist that, you know, it's also our resistance to our grief, right? Because there is such a loss when that person just, where we're like, why don't you care enough about me to just do this? Like, how hard is this, right? Like we can fumble over that so many times. And I think that is, you know, our self-protection of having to make contact with our grief, our sadness, our anger, you know, all of the things that, you know, might fill us up in that space. So it does take discernment. There are times where I think it is appropriate to name something with a parent and share that, but it takes an emotionally available, emotionally mature parent to receive that. And if your parent isn't in that space right now, then generally it is not advised to mm-hmm. keep going back to the space where you're just going to be met with resistance.
Totally. But I think in what you're saying, other people can't change, but if you've like gone on this journey, you can change. And with that, yes. I think that's when you can start having boundaries for yourself, showing up differently. What do you do when you start showing up differently? What commonly happens in family dynamics? And just, I'm asking multiple questions at one time. So like, what does that, and then just, can you kind of go into what boundaries are and what they're not in that setting? I am, I could ask you so many questions, but you have a podcast yourself where you have these conversations all the time. So with the last of our time together, can you just talk more about what you do on your podcast, what type of conversations you have for people who are, you know, maybe starting this work? I think sometimes therapy can be a big jump at first. And that's why I think podcasting is so amazing, because you can get more information. And then if therapy is something that, you know, you can warm up to, that can be a next step. But I would just love for you to just share more about what you're doing.
It's so well said, right? Because I think for a lot of people, you're right. It's a little bit scary. It's a little intimidating. I was like, what am I going to walk into? And yeah, the podcast, this keeps happening. I speak with anonymous guests and I get to talk to someone. It's a one-time thing. Like, I don't know them before. I don't have history on them. So it's quite different than therapy, because there's really no relationship. There's no like safety, security, trust, you know, that's been established. But it's really incredible to see what humans coming together, you know, sort of in this very intentional space to talk about a challenge that they're facing or a pattern that they can't shake. A lot of the things that we're talking about today, their origin wounds, where we sit down for an hour together and see what we might be able to uncover or accomplish. And it's been a really incredible professional challenge for me. I am very comfortable in the therapy space. And even though it will sound like you're listening in to someone's therapy session, it is such a different experience than that, because we don't know each other. And yeah, it's so beautiful. And I think to your point, I always say this, that sometimes looking at ourselves can be a really hard place to start. But sometimes when we listen to somebody else who represents something within us, we might see ourselves in them, or we might see our partner in them, or we might see our adult child in this person. And it's the same with the book, right? I think it's like these things that are these steps in that direction, where I get to read from the comfort of my own home. I get to read about all of these client stories, and I'm going to resonate with something, even if my story isn't exactly the same as the one that's being shown to me in these pages, right? Like, the show and the book, I think, are such a beautiful invitation for people to see themselves in someone else. And I think that's one of the nicest ways to begin to come in contact with this work, when we're like, oh, like, this is just, it's hard, and it's hard stuff, right? But to be like, okay, like, how do I just gently dip my toes into this water? And I think those are really good ways to do that.
I think so too. Thank you so much, Vienna, for your time, for your knowledge, for sharing more of your story. Like you said, that's my hope with the podcast, is that it can make you see a little bit of yourself in our conversations and help maybe change its trajectory, make you think a little bit different, maybe take a first step. And I think the origin of you and your podcast, This Keeps Happening, is a great step for you guys who really resonate with this and are interested. So just, I enjoyed this conversation. Like I said, I have like one full page of notes that I didn't even get to, of questions that I have, but you just have some great work out. Oh, and your Instagram, you're always posting so many amazing like thoughts for people to really be able to like interact with. So I love that what you're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. Such an honor to be here, and really enjoyed this conversation with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you guys so much for listening to the episode. Better Tomorrow is produced by me, Hannah Brown, and Legos Creative. Our show is recorded, engineered, and edited by the Legos Creative team. Remember to follow Better Tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss the next episode. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps and shows your support. You can follow me on socials at Hannah Brown, and you can stay updated on all things Better Tomorrow on our Instagram at Better Tomorrow and our TikTok Better Tomorrow Podcast.